When I talk for a long time, I definitely start spitting and a squirting.
Look, we are already so close to just becoming a fetish podcast. The spitting, the squirting.
Do it.
Literary ASMR. We ready? We feeling good?
Yeah. Is that not convincing?
No. Never better.
Is it my dead eyes that give it away?
We are both at the absolute pinnacle of our creative and official careers.
Uh-huh.
Everything is going well at home.
Oh, yeah. Nothing
we are,
is stressful.
We are financially and existentially comfortable.
Oh, yeah. Big time.
We are beneficiaries of the patriarchy.
Oh, yeah.
Everything is coming up Milhouse.
Big time. You say those affirmations. Manifestation.
Books. Books. Books.
Books. Hello and welcome to Didn't Read It, the podcast that's hoping you won't realize it's an imposter with no real qualifications.
Oh, please.
I am your host, Grace Todd.
It's okay. That's enough.
I'm here.
You're enough.
Thank you. You're
welcome.
Who are you?
I don't even know anymore. Question for the ages. I'm Lee, and I'm also here, and we're here together.
And we're Knuff.
Gosh darn it.
How you doing, babe?
Oh, you know.
Uh-huh. Yep. We're having a banner week here.
Oh, yeah.
At Didn't Read It headquarters.
Yeah.
A podcast that definitely has a headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
We're in it.
Yep. It belongs, it's ours.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Special thanks again to Black Iris for letting us record.
It's great. Beautiful. Beautiful lair.
It is a beautiful lair, and I like it very much. The furniture's nice.
Yes.
Lovely furniture.
Oh, the loveliest.
The other members are very nice. They're friendly. I enjoy spending time here. It is not, however, like a headquarters as such.
Not yet.
But it is today.
Yes. That's the attitude.
Lee,
mm-hmm.
Read anything good lately?
Right now, I'm reading nonfiction. I'm reading The Body is Not an Apology, which is great, by Sonia Renee Taylor, I think is her name. It's great. Thinking about buying the accompanying workbook.
Ooh.
Lovely. Before that, I read a book which I might be presenting on this very podcast.
Oh.
In who knows how long. So I'm just going to leave it at that.
All right. All right, then. Keep your secrets.
Yeah. That's for me to know and you to find out.
Well, I hope so. Otherwise, we're not going to have much of an episode.
I hope so, too.
If you just come and tell yourself about it without me in the room, be a little
I talk one-sided. To myself all the time.
I mean, you could try it. I could take a week off. Could set the equipment up and just leave you to it. Go take a nap.
You know, that sounds very artistic, very adventurous.
Doing a two-person podcast, but with one person and just leaving various lengths of silence. The audience would provide their own response.
Mm.
And you just leave them the space to do it.
Mm.
We'll leave a space now for the audience to say their part.
Oh, yes, that's a good point.
Yeah, that was really... Wow.
mm-hmm.
Well,
This is going well.
Uh-huh. Yep. Yeah. Speaking of people talking to themselves and needing to have their egos shored up by strangers,
mm-hmm.
What do you know about Patricia Highsmith?
Nothing. I know nothing.
All right. You have probably heard of some of her books.
We'll see.
She wrote The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Oh.
Yep.
And I've heard of that movie.
And also Strangers on a Train.
I've
also heard of that movie.
Yes.
Because it was adapted by Alfred Hitchcock.
Ah.
Yeah.
I have also heard of him.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very cultured.
Well done.
Thank you.
You passed the pop quiz.
Ah.
Okay. So Patricia Highsmith.
So she started all that stuff.
She did start all of that stuff. Good job, Lee.
All right. Okay, I haven't talked to anyone today before this, so except for my dogs.
In true me fashion, I feel like this keeps happening. I did not realize until after I had already decided to do this for the show that there is a new Netflix adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley that came out like today. As we're recording this.
Oh, wow.
Which is going to be like at least a week before the actual episode drops. But
talk about a little marketing bump.
Yeah, because I was sitting at breakfast this morning like idly. You know, like I'll Google authors sometimes just kind of to see like what's floating around in the zeitgeist.
Mm-hmm.
And there were like three or four brand new articles from Vanity Fair and The Guardian being like, who was Patricia Highsmith?
And you're like, what is going on?
And I was like, that's weird.
Sospechoso.
And then I found out it was because Netflix is doing another adaptation of The Talented Mr. Ripley right now.
I don't know what that is about, and I always get it confused with Good Will Hunting.
It's a very particular, very pretty era of Matt Damon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Blonde?
Blonde, young.
Mm-hmm.
With that smooth face.
Blonde, young. Smooth face. That sounds like an AI Tinder profile.
Blonde smooth face.
Blonde young smooth face.
Swipe right on blonde young smooth face.
Yeah. 2.6 miles away.
Today we are not going to delve into The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Okay.
I might at some point do an episode on the novel. I might at some point do a bonus episode about the novel and the new adaptation.
Ooh.
Sort of how they pair up.
Did they send it to you to preview?
Oh, God. No.
Yeah. Oh.
No.
You're not on their PR list.
Shockingly, no.
Weird.
Today, we're going to talk about a short story that came quite a while after The Talented Mr. Ripley was written. She wrote, this is from a collection that she wrote in the 80s, toward the end of her career.
Yeah, so when was she alive?
So she was born in 1920, actually, hang on. I have this bookmark. So she was born in 1921.
Okay.
In Texas.
Ooh, yeehaw.
Yeah, yeehaw indeed. did something about that tickle you?
Oh no, it was just so like understated and academic. Yeehaw indeed. It's like what a news anchor would say.
Look, this is who I am. Take it or leave it.
I take it with a smile.
So she was born in Texas. Her parents divorced right before she was born. Very, very quick synopsis of her early life. Her mother remarried a man that she, according to her, hated at first sight. Although she met him for the first time when she was 3 and a half. And I think maybe she's exaggerating a little.
That was such a quick succession of different kinds of information. Hold on a second. Okay, go on.
And then her mother and stepfather moved the family to Manhattan, to New York.
Wait, Patricia hated him at first sight.
Oh, yes,
the mom
sorry.
Didn't hate him at first sight.
Yeah, no, so Patricia says that she hated her stepfather as soon as she met him.
But she was only three.
She was 3 and a half.
She was 3 and a half. And then they moved, you said they moved to?
Manhattan.
Manhattan. And she still hated him?
Oh, she hated him for her entire life.
She always hated. Okay, so that was very consistent for her.
Yes. She also hated a lot of people. Most people?
Okay.
We'll get to that after we talk about the story.
Okay. Hashtag relatable.
This is a woman who is full of rage.
Okay. Just an angry little Texas woman.
She had short stories published in high school and college. And then Strangers on a Train was published in 1950.
Okay.
She also wrote The Price of Salt, which was the basis of the movie Carol.
Oh.
Yeah. which she originally published under a pseudonym, and was her mother wound up outing her as the author of The Price of Salt to a like a priest.
Huh.
Her mother, I guess, went to her pastor or somebody and was like, my daughter wrote this raunchy novel.
And then the priest told people?
I guess so.
That's specifically what he's not supposed to do.
Well, I'm not sure it was in the seal of confession. Her mother was not Catholic.
Okay. I was about to say, because then that's fine for the mother. It's only the priest that we should really be mad at.
Only Catholics have that. Well, and probably Episcopal. Anyone who does confession, but like...
Yeah,
evangelicals.
Just talking to a priest on the sidewalk.
Yeah, they don't do confession. They don't have like the seal of the confessional.
Well, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and then the Ripley books started coming out in
the Ripley books.
Oh yeah, there's a bunch of them.
The Talented Mr. Ripley, the Gassy Mr. Ripley, the Ponderous Mr. Ripley.
I don't know why I'm having
Mr. Ripley's little brother. Jake.
Just ignoring you.
My brain is not
there. We go.
Tip top today.
Talented Mr. Ripley was published in 1955.
Okay.
She had a very long, pretty prolific writing career, and this is a short story collection that came out in 1985. And then she ultimately died in 1995.
Ooh, okay.
So this is late in her career.
Okay.
And she's been living outside of the United States for a long time by the time this comes out. Although she does take a trip back to do some research for a novel she's working on about the sort of religious evangelical right.
Ooh.
And I think that's definitely an influence on this story.
Okay.
The story is the second in the collection. The collection is called Mermaids on the Golf Course. And this is a short story called Where the Action Is.
Okay.
And I have one quick note for you, actually.
Okay.
Before we get started.
Okay.
This is a story that nominally hinges around a rape.
Okay.
It's a little hard to believe until you get into the story. The rape is kind of the least important part of the story in a lot of ways.
Okay.
But in this context, and especially with this author and this story, I think it's very important when we are going through the story and when we are talking about it afterwards to stay very mindful about delineating between characters and real people.
Yeah.
So like just be mindful as you're going through the story to really think about these as characters who are being moved around by an author for an end.
Yeah, serve a purpose.
Yes, okay. And not as like real people that real things are happening to.
Yeah, that makes sense.
There's an interesting kind of fairy tale like quality to a lot of Highsmith's short stories.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the characters move around in a way that is almost like archetypal,
mm-hmm.
fairy tale character-y. And they lack a certain amount of depth in some ways and have a lot of depth in other ways. But they don't always behave in ways that make a lot of sense if they were actual, like, flesh and blood humans.
Yeah, okay.
Because of the story, I am just going to say the word rape a lot.
Got it.
Because when I'm reading directly from the story, I am going to use the word assault when we are talking about it, mostly because I just don't like saying...
saying it over and over again?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But this has very little bearing on any of the realities around sexual assault.
Okay.
I think it's saying some really interesting things about feminism and women and sexuality, and
mm-hmm.
but I think it has vanishingly little to do with actual sexual assault and survivors of assault and what that means or even meant when the story was written in the 80s.
Very interesting. I'd be very interested to hear the story.
With that slightly torturous caveat, we're going to dive into where the action is.
Okay.
Here it was. Some action, finally. An armed holdup of a town bus, and Craig Rollins was in urgent need of a toilet. Nevertheless, Craig raised his camera once again and snapped, just as a scared-looking man was hopping down the steps of the halted bus. Then Craig ran, heading for Eats and Takeaway, where he knew there was a men's room by the telephones. Craig was back in something under a minute, but by then the action seemed to be over. He hadn't heard any gunshots. A cop was blowing a whistle. An ambulance had pulled up, but Craig didn't see anybody who was wounded. So Craig is a freelance photographer.
All right.
Who has turned up with, it sounds like, characteristically poor timing in the aftermath of an armed robbery on a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Which seems a little, I'm still not entirely clear on the logistics of how one performs an armed robbery of a bus.
Like a public bus?
Yes. With like 30 plus people on it.
It sounds like maybe a crime of desperation.
Yeah, I'm sure. Yeah. But the moral of the story is that somehow three armed men with...
Oh, well, you got three men, you know, that makes it a little easier.
It's true.
Yeah.
It still seems complicated, but whatever.
Now we're cooking with gas.
They got on the bus. They somehow stopped the bus. They took a bunch of people's wallets and purses.
You stopped the bus by waving the gun at people and say, stop it.
I'm not even sure. Okay, they did have a gun. One guy had
Grace,
a gun.
All right, let's go down. Let me show you how to do this. It's not that hard.
If I get arrested, it's because Lee tried to show me hands-on how to rob a bus.
Yeah, it's for the podcast.
So the passengers are off the bus now. Two of the men are being arrested. The passengers are all milling around complaining that their purses and things have been taken.
Mm.
And another freelance photographer turns up, Tom Buckley.
Tom.
Who asks Craig if he got any good shots of the action. Craig didn't want to ask if Tom had got a shot of the guy with the gun, because Craig had missed this shot, which might have been possible at exactly the time he had had to dash to a men's room. He moved closer to the police wagon and took a picture of the two young men, who looked about 20, as they were urged into the back of the wagon. Tom Buckley was also snapping. One, or maybe even two, of Tom's photos would make it in the afternoon edition of the Evening Star, Craig was thinking. Craig shot up the rest... Grog.
Sorry.
Was Grog there?
Also, there's a third character, and his name is Grog. He also has a camera.
Craig shot up the rest of his roll, aiming at any place. At a cop reassuring an elderly woman, at a girl rushing from a narrow passageway into Main Street where the bus was, and being greeted by a man and a woman who might have been her parents. He thinks he hasn't gotten anything worthwhile. He just kind of finishes taking pictures just to do it,
mm-hmm.
Goes home to develop his pictures. He lives with his parents. He's converted his bathroom into a dark room.
Okay.
And
can I ask you a question?
Mm.
What happened to the third person?
We will find out.
Oh, sorry. I was being perceptive.
He goes home. He develops his pictures and it says, no action in them, apart from a cluttered street scene of people looking bewildered. Still, Craig presented them at the office of, you know what? I forgot to look up how to pronounce this town name.
Can I see? Canduck.
We'll go with that.
Either that or Canduck.
It's in
Canduck,
Wyoming, if that helps.
I don't know what Wyoming people sound like. Canduck.
We have one. So the one listener we have in Wyoming is very,
like,
very offended now.
I thought you were going to say we have like one brain cell between us today. And
that is also true.
That's also, yeah.
The one brain cell's in Wyoming.
Yeah. And he's.
All right. So he's developed the pictures. He doesn't think they're very good.
Mm.
Still, Craig presented them at the office of Canduck's Evening Star about 12:30, imagining that Tom Buckley had got there a few minutes earlier and with better photos.
Tom.
He's really into Tom. Oh. Or specifically, he's constantly thinking about the fact that Tom is objectively the better and more successful photographer.
Mm.
He's also a little older than Craig. And...
Tom.
Ed Simmons bent his balding head over Craig's 10 photographs. The big messy room held 7 people at their desks, and there was the usual clatter of typewriters. Got there a little late, Craig murmured apologetically. not caring if Ed heard him or not. Hey, you got Lizzie Davis? With her folks! Hey, Craig, this one is great! We'll use this one. Just the moment after, running out of that alley. Beautiful! Didn't know her name, Craig said, and wondered why Ed was so excited. Ed showed the photo to a man at another desk. Others gathered to look at the picture, which was of a girl of 20 or younger, with long dark hair, her white blouse partially pulled out of her skirt top, looking anxious as she rushed forward towards a man and a woman approaching her from Main Street. This is the girl who was nearly raped. Or maybe she even was, Ed Simmons said to Craig. Didn't you know that? Craig certainly hadn't heard. Raped by whom, he wondered. Then the snatches of conversation that he heard enlightened him. The third holdup boy, who was still at large, had dragged Lizzie Davis off the bus and into an alley and threatened to stick a knife in her throat or to rape her unless she kept her mouth shut when the police came up the alley. The police hadn't come up the alley. In the picture, Lizzie's father, in a pale business suit and straw hat, was just about to touch his daughter's shoulder, while her mother, on the right in the picture, rushed towards the girl with both arms spread. Now he saw, in the upside-down photo on Ed's desk, that the girl's eyes were squeezed shut with horror or fear, and her mouth open as if she were crying or gasping for breath. Was she raped? Craig asked. The reply he got was vague, the implication being that the girl wasn't telling. So Craig's photo appeared on page 2 of the Kianduck Evening Star that day, and one by Tom Buckley of a local cop with two of the holdup boys on the front page. Both photographs had a 2-column spread. So he's gotten this picture of this very fraught moment mm-hmm. of a girl who was maybe assaulted in an alleyway?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not? Unclear.
Who was held hostage. Who was held hostage at knife point and possibly assaulted.
Yes.
Yeah.
And that is enough for his otherwise kind of, you know, whatever photos. But that one sticks out. And it's pretty clearly not because of the photo itself,
mm-hmm.
but because of the salaciousness of the story around it.
Yeah.
But either way, Craig's pretty impressed with himself. Mm-hmm. He goes home to have dinner with his parents. He points out that he's got a photo in the newspaper that evening, which...
Isn't that his job?
Well, he's a freelancer.
Oh, right.
So he's sort of between the lines here. Craig is not exactly like a go-getter.
Yeah.
He's not doing very well for himself.
Yeah.
He's a freelance photographer who succeeds in actually getting paid for his photos rarely enough that he goes home to be like, look, I got one in. And his parents are like, that's great.
Good job, Craig.
He brags to his girlfriend, who...
Isn't Tom.
Ugh. But her name is Constance O'Leary, and everyone calls her Clancy.
Clancy. It's all coming together.
It's all coming together.
Clancy. That's cute.
Yeah. Well, it's also just, it's a pretty masculine nickname.
Sure is.
If there's one thing Patricia Highsmith really knows how to do, it's writing believable heterosexual relationships.
Like, I understand these. They're simple. Put a man, a woman.
It's.
There you go.
It's Patricia Highsmith writes straight people the way that straight men write lesbians.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes, I get it.
Except with way less interest in the sex part.
Yeah. She's like, just, I don't know, whatever. They're,
just like a complete and total inability to imagine what could possibly be appealing.
Yeah.
About being in a heterosexual relationship.
She's like, they're friends, I guess. I don't, well, whatever. Moving on.
As an example, the only thing Clancy says or gets to say on the page in response to Craig bragging about his photo is, you're the greatest. Just like.
Oh, wait, who said that?
Clancy. It's Clancy.
Yeah.
Because that's.
She's like, gee willikers.
Yeah. Gee whiz, you're great.
I sure am fond of you.
But the photo is beginning to gain a life of its own. So someone from the New York Times sees it and they ask to reprint it. in a series that they're doing.
Is Kanduk a real place?
I didn't actually remember to check.
Let me check real quick.
All right. Look it up.
Because if it is, I want to rescind my jokes. I was making fun of it because I thought it wasn't real. It is not.
Oh, good.
Resume jokes.
So Craig goes in to sell some more photos. They're all terrible. He makes a point of saying that Tom Buckley probably took better ones at the same events.
Tom just with his throbbing finger on the shutter button.
Yeah.
He's just so good.
And Ed doesn't buy any of the photos he has today. But still, Craig's dazed smile at the news about the New York Times lingered on his face as he left the office. He'd never yet had a photo in the New York Times. What was so great about that picture?
I don't know.
He's baffled.
He does not understand photography.
No, not even a little. It says, Craig found out some 5 days later. His photograph was one of three in the first of a three-part series of articles in the New York Times called Crime in America's Streets. His photograph had been cleverly cut to show it to better advantage, Craig noticed. The text beneath said, A young woman in a small town in Wyoming rushes towards her parents, seconds after being held hostage under threat of rape by one of a three-man armed holdup team who robbed bus passengers in mid-morning. When Craig showed the article to his parents that evening, he saw real joy and surprise in their faces. Their son, with his work in the New York Times.
Oh.
And then they immediately start talking about Lizzie herself.
Oh.
Because this is a small town, right? Right?
Yeah.
Craig's father points out that Lizzie's a changed girl. And his mother says, Edna Schwartz was talking about Lizzie just yesterday. Told me Lizzie's broken off her engagement. You know, she was supposed to get married in late June, Craig. Craig hadn't known. Was she really raped? He asked, as if his parents might know the truth. As indeed they might, because his mother worked behind the counter of Odds and Ends, a shop that sold dry goods and buttons, and his mother chatted with nearly every woman of the town. And his father certainly saw a lot of people in the hardware store. She's saying so, his mother replied in a whisper. At least she's hinting at it. And nobody knows if she broke off her engagement or her boyfriend did. We find out that her fiancé was a boy named Pete Walsh. Paul Walsh.
I was like, wait a minute. Wasn't he in Fallout Boy?
Well, no. It's actually, his mother says Pete Walsh, and then his father corrects her and says Paul Walsh. Maybe he was in Fallout Boy.
I don't think so.
But the Walshes, it's pointed out, are from... are a well-to-do family in a neighborhood famous for its fine houses.
Who broke off the engagement?
No one knows, right? What his parents are talking about is that no one knows if Lizzie broke off the engagement or Paul did. But it is broken off.
Yeah.
And Craig's only editorialization on the situation is he immediately assumes it was the Walsh family, probably because they're rich. Snobs, he thought. To break an engagement these days because a girl's virginity might have been lost. Like prehistoric times.
When is this story set?
It isn't really clear. It kind of seems like it could have been any time in the 70s or early 80s. I'm assuming roughly contemporarily with when it was published.
Yeah.
The rest of the series in the New York Times comes out and he reads it with careful attention. A series about car thefts, robberies of apartments, muggings, plus the efforts of the police in big cities to control such crime, of course, but also about the danger of its increasing, now that unemployment was spreading among the under 25s.
Tell me about it.
And there are a few photos in the series that he really admires that are objectively good photographs, and it concludes with, Now these were damned good photographs. Why had they liked his so much? Because Lizzie Davis's face was pretty? Or because she really had been raped? And it's...
Okay.
He's just like...
Craig.
It's so... Like, as a character, Craig is such a portrait of a very particular... You're getting an image, right, of the character that Highsmith is creating here.
Yeah.
He's very hung up on... the question of what really happened, but also not really.
Well, not because of the event itself, but because of what it means for, like, am I a good photographer? Am I as good as Tom?
Yes.
Yeah.
He, like, this character is primarily interested in what has happened to other people insofar as they reflect on him.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Because he is, because this character has the mental complexity of a 12-year-old, he goes to Clancy, his girlfriend, and asks her what she thinks of the Lizzie Davis thing. Craig says that he finds the idea that she, that Lizzie Davis was assaulted in the span of what he says was about 5 minutes, unlikely.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the story kind of dances around is whether or not it really was such a short period of time. It seems like it was, but it's not really clear.
Well, I'm going to say something that I was thinking in the beginning and that is inappropriate for the seriousness of the topic, but it really depends on whether Craig went number one or number two when he went away to go to the bathroom. I almost asked that in the beginning, but I was like, it probably doesn't matter.
Yeah, it says...
But if this were Law and Order and we were at the courtroom part...
Dun, dun.
Dun, dun. The lawyer would be like, was it number one or number two? How can you be sure it was only 5 minutes? Have you been drinking enough water lately? What's your fiber intake? I object.
It says in the opening passage that Craig was back in something under a minute, but we also don't know how reliable. This is in essentially, it's in Craig's perspective,
but
right?
But he said he missed all the action. Right?
I think the action was supposed to have happened very quickly.
Right. Right.
But again, this is written in very close third. Yeah. It is in Craig's perspective.
He's
there's
like,
no...
But assault can't happen in less than a minute.
Right.
That's how Craig talks.
That is how Craig talks, yes.
He just sounds like Doug the dog.
And so he tells Clancy that he doesn't believe it. And she... responds with,
she's like, okay, heterosexual heterosexual partner,
kinda,
you
yeah.
got it.
It says, she says, she also tells him that Lizzie was interviewed by a journalist from Chicago, but anyway, Lizzie doesn't go out much anymore, or so I've heard. Stays at home. She's like a psycho. What, said Craig, you mean she's gone nuts at home? And home is italicized, and it made me giggle every time. At where is she supposed to go nuts, Craig? Or Patricia, or whoever?
Craig was clearly never in a 18-month nationwide lockdown.
At home?
At home? But home is where your parents take care of you.
At the same time, Craig was thinking that another photo or two of Lizzie Davis might be a good idea. Saleable.
Oh, no.
I don't mean nuts, Clancy said, her freckled face sobering with thought for a moment. Just that she's not interested in any kind of social life anymore. She's become some sort of a recluse.
Is that how it's written?
It's spelled out R-E-C-K hyphen L-O-O-S-E. Recluse.
Very clever, Clancy.
That was a bit of a puzzle to Craig Rollins, but then he didn't understand girls completely and didn't really want to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he reiterates that he's not sure that the assault actually happened and concludes with, maybe she was putting on an act, breaking her engagement with the Walsh fellow because she didn't really want to marry him. And this is another one of those things where I want to be like, these are characters.
Yeah.
These are characters written by a woman who found heterosexual relations horrifying.
Well, and as you said, I guess you said that it's narrated in close third, like we're just getting an unfiltered view of Craig the character's dumb little thoughts.
Yep.
Yeah.
And then Craig finds out that he's won the Pulitzer Prize for newspaper photography.
Congratulations, Craig.
Well, and the best part is,
I'm sure you understand why.
he gets a letter and he doesn't believe it. And he says, it says, Craig was afraid to mention the Pulitzer letter to his parents. It might be a joke.
It's probably Tom pranking me.
And there's a little bit of logistics here. He gets a phone call and then they send him plane tickets and then he realizes it's actually real.
Yeah.
And he very adorably walks into the kitchen and says, well, Ma, I won the Pulitzer for my photo of Lissy Davis.
Oh, my God. It's feeling camp.
We're just wait.
Okay.
So he goes. He goes to the Pulitzer ceremony. And all of a sudden, he's becoming real deal famous, right? He's starting to get phone calls. He's starting to get letters.
He is failing the f- up.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
It says, teenagers start writing to him asking if he gives photography lessons. And it says, this made Craig smile because he had never had any lessons himself, apart from a course in high school. Of course, he had dropped after a month because the work had become too complicated.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And then he starts getting invitations to, like, go on the lecture circuit.
Yes, he should do that. I want him to do that.
Which he intends to refuse. Quote, on the grounds that he had never made a speech in his life and that the idea terrified him. But after a good dinner at home and mentioning these invitations to his parents, and his parents saying in their old-fashioned way, sure you can, Craig, if you just put your mind to it. Be friendly. People just want to see you and meet you now. And he accepts the offers. And he starts lecturing on photojournalism.
This feels like Fargo.
And he lecturing on waiting for a good photogenic story, hoping even for a fire, though maybe it wasn't very nice to hope for a fire that might hurt people. And then this had happened. This a minor tragedy by world standards, but upsetting for some 30 or 40 ordinary citizens. Disastrous for the young girl called Lissy Davis, who had intended to marry in a few days, but whose life had been shattered, maybe ruined, by crime in the streets.
Mm.
Craig hammered the crime angle, because the articles on crime in the streets had launched his photograph.
Mm-hmm.
It says, after four speeches, Craig had got the hang of it.
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Nailed it.
And the fees are mounting. He's getting ever-increasing job offers.
Yeah, Craig.
He's negotiating hard.
Has he taken another picture at this point?
No.
Yeah. Cool.
With the extra money from his speeches, Craig Rollins was a changed young man.
Yes.
He was able to buy more clothes. Ooh. And discovered that he had a taste for quality in clothes and also in food.
Mm.
He acquired a new Japanese camera that could do more things than his old ones, which were secondhand anyway.
Yes.
He still had Clancy as his main girlfriend, but he had met a girl called Sue in Houston who seemed to like him a lot and who had the money to fly to meet him sometimes in a town where he was making a speech. A pretty girl beside him enhanced his image, Craig had noticed.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yes.
Which is a good point to, like, pause for a second and point out how sexless this story is.
Yeah.
Especially for a heterosexual man as the narrator.
Yes, he's very heterosexual.
He's the most...
Yeah.
The most man.
He is a... Grace just gave a thumbs up. He's straight.
And he's also started going to a better barber.
Mm.
His hair was not so short, and the barber fluffed it out in a style that Craig might have called sissy a few months ago. Although no one could possibly have called Craig or his face sissy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He had the head and neck of a line hitter, a tackle, which he had been on the high school football team, and in his first year at Greaves College. Craig's grades would have gotten him kicked out of almost any college he knew, but Greaves had been willing to keep him on because of his football prowess. The coach had thought he might make All-American, but Craig had quit college after a month in sophomore year out of sheer boredom with the scholastic part of it.
Well, can't fault him for that.
But now he's feeling great about himself.
He's doing great.
He writes back to one of the newspapers that offers him a job and says that he's considering another offer, but if they add another $50,000 to the salary, he might take it.
Yeah, Craig. Ride it while it's, while the train's choo-chooing.
And after all of this success, Clancy asks if he's been to see Lizzie at all.
Shut up, Clancy!
And he says, no, why should I?
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it might be nice. She did bring you a lot of luck, and it seems she's so sad. So Craig calls up Lizzie and asks if he can go and visit her. And she agrees. Craig picks up a bouquet of flowers and brings his camera with him.
Of course.
She lets him in, she puts the flowers in a vase, and then they sit down. Craig sat down in the rather swank living room. The Davises had a lot more money than his family. Lizzie came back and set the vase in the center of the coffee table between them. Then she proceeded to tell him about her broken engagement, 5 months ago now, and how quiet her life had been since. In a way, I've lost my self-confidence, my self-respect. No use trying to gain it back, Lizzie said. That was shattering that day. How had they got here so quickly, Craig wondered.
Liz, Whoa. Trying to bring you some flowers, maybe snap a picture.
Lizzie was talking to him as if he were interviewing her, though he hadn't asked her a single question. And I do think that's interesting. I mean, in part, yes, Craig is obviously like, well, I don't want to talk about this.
Yeah.
But I think it's also meant to emphasize how much Lizzie, too, has kind of fallen into a script about that day.
Yeah.
Because it's also become a centralized feature in her life.
Yeah.
And this is what she's used to, is people showing up and sitting down and saying, okay, now tell me about the photo, you know?
Yeah.
But she goes on to say, just this afternoon, you won't believe it, I was being photographed in Cheyenne for a perfume ad. I've become a photographer's model. Maybe because I want to get the phobia of photographs out of my soul. Maybe I'm succeeding. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Craig was wordless for a moment. You mean, my picture embarrassed you so much? I'm sorry. Not the picture so much. What happened? Lizzie replied, lifting her round dark eyes to his. Well, it wasn't your fault, and the picture brought you huge success, I know. It ruined my engagement, but, well, in a way, I'm lucky too, because there's a market for a sad dog face like mine.
Ooh.
I can see that. The other day I even posed for an ad for men's clothing. You won't believe it, but I was supposed to be the girl with the knowing eyes, for clothing, that is, whose face would brighten up if the fellow I liked just wore good-looking clothes, see? Very complicated, but it really came off. Craig saw Lizzie's face brighten briefly when she described the way the girl's face would brighten if her boyfriend only wore good clothes. Then an instant later, Lizzie's glum expression was back, as if it were a garment she wore for the public. And he asks about her fiancé, and whether she thinks they'll get back together again. And she says, no. No, indeed. I felt as if I'd never want to live with a man as long as I live. Still do feel that way. And Craig points out to himself that Lizzie isn't even 19 yet. And again, circles around this idea that she's lying, and that maybe specifically that she's lying in order to have an excuse to break things off
mm-hmm.
with this man.
Mm-hmm.
And then he asks if he can take more pictures of her.
Yes. Yes, Craig. You read that room.
But she agrees.
Mm-hmm.
And he takes a few photos of her, and he starts thinking about some journalists he knows, and that he can pitch a piece. So he goes home and he calls up a journalist that he knows. And the piece that he's pitching is that he would be the puzzled, guilt-ridden, small-town photographer who had contributed to, even caused, the upset of a young woman's life. And the journalist asks if the assault really happened. And Craig almost says, never mind.
That's not what the piece is about.
But instead, he replied, she certainly implied she was. Girls never want to say it flat out, you know. But you get my angle, that I'm the one upset now, mm-hmm. because I... Craig squeezed his eyes shut, thinking hard. Because I captured in a split second that expression of a girl who's just been assaulted, you know? And then he calls up Tom Buckley to come take photos of him.
Yes. Photograph me, Tom. Just so.
Tom, who it's pointed out, is still friendly with Craig and had never shown the least jealousy of Craig's success.
Aw.
Tom Buckley came over the next morning to photograph Craig in his modest darkroom at home and at his work table, brooding over a print of the now famous Crime in America's Streets photo of Lizzie Davis. In this shot, Craig held the photograph at an angle at which it was recognizable, and in his other hand, he held his head in the manner of a man with a terrible headache or tortured by guilt.
Is the Pulitzer in the frame?
I hope so. Tom chuckled a little as he snapped this one. Good angle. Yeah, you're feeling sorry for the girl. She's doing fine, I heard, with her modeling work. Craig straightened up. But I do feel sorry for her. Sorry about her shame and all that stuff. She sure called her marriage off.
Shame and sh-.
And Tom says, she wasn't mad about that guy, and he wasn't about her. One of these things the parents were keen on, you know? Everybody in town knows that. You haven't been paying much attention to town gossip, Craig, old boy. Too busy with your big town newspapers lately.
It's going to turn into a sex scene. Sorry.
And it says, Tom is just like, kind of like giving him a little bit of hard time, but in a very good natured mm-hmm. way. And it says,
you forgot about all of us, Craig. Sorry, it's not turning into a sex scene.
Unfortunately, no. In a curious way, Craig realized that he had to hold on to his conviction that Lizzie Davis's life had been altered, ruined, or he couldn't make a success of the article plus photos that he had in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And Craig asks Tom again, like he's been asking the whole story, if he thinks it really happened. And Tom says, phony? Sure, little bit. Not worth much thought, is it? All the public wants is a sensational photo. Someone killing themselves jumping off a building, somebody else getting shot. The hell with who's to blame for it. Just give the public the action. The sex angle in your Lizzie picture gave it its kick, you know? Who cares if she's telling the truth or not?
I mean, Tom gets the game.
Tom understands.
Tom understands the publicity game.
And after Tom leaves, Craig continues to meditate on it. And it says, Craig was sure Tom was right. Tom was a bright fellow.
And so handsome.
And so pretty. And so talented.
His hands are so soft.
He's just
a little rough.
The public wanted pictures of buildings bombed high in the air, a wrecked car with a body in it, or bodies lying on pavements. Action. Even the story wasn't terribly important if the picture was eye-catching. Now Craig struggled like a drowning person to hang on to the Lizzie story, that she had been raped and had broken her engagement because of the rape. Craig knew he would have to talk to Richard Prescott as if he believed what he was saying.
Richard Prescott is the journalist.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
And so he does. And it says he prepared himself as if he were an actor. He emoted. He struck his forehead a couple of times, grimaced, and a genuine tear came to support him. Though Prescott had a tape recorder and not a camera, unfortunately.
My talents are wasted on this.
And he goes on this rant. And it's, you know, he's going on about the awful moment when he realized what he'd captured and this girl and her parents in the most dramatic moment of their lives. And he goes on to say, it really didn't seem fair. It made me rethink my whole life. I thought about fate, money, fame. I even thought about God.
Wow.
And the reporter, much like Tom Prescott, clearly does not care. Like, he's smoking a cigarette. He's not even really listening. He finally cuts him off and is like, you've talked through two tapes already. I think you've probably said enough stuff.
Oh, my God.
At the end, he gives a laugh. The reporter laughs and says, that bit about religion at the end. You thinking of writing a book, maybe? Might sell.
Oh, no. Why did you say that? Richard. Keep it to yourself.
And Craig's feelings have been hurt by the fact that the reporter obviously is not buying anything Craig is selling emotionally. But the article that comes out is perfect.
Yeah, yeah.
Tom's done a wonderful job. In his photos, Craig looked serious in one, agonized in the other. An excellent, if only one, picture of Lizzie Davis showed her seated in an armchair in her house, holding what the caption stated was a print of the photograph that had changed her life. Lizzie looked hopeful, modest and pretty, as she stared the camera right in its eye.
I'm just imagining Craig doing like a Hamlet pose with the skull, but instead of the skull, it's the f***ing photograph.
Uh-huh. That is exactly what you should be imagining.
Yeah, just like stage lighting.
And of course, that article means that he gets even more invitations to go on the lecture circuit.
Mm-hmm. Because now he's a tortured sad boy.
And that's what he starts working into the speeches.
Yeah.
And he finally turns down the very expensive staff photography job that they've been trying to give him this whole time.
Smart. Very smart.
Because Craig had higher aspirations. He was going to write a book about it all. When he thought of fate's part in it, God's part, his brain seemed to expand and take wings of fancy. He might call his book Fate Took the Picture, or maybe The Lens and the Soul. The word conscience in the title might be a bit heavy. Craig gave a few more talks and managed easily to bring his religious thoughts and pangs of conscience into his text. Life is not fair sometimes, and it troubles me, he would say, to an awed or at least respectfully listening audience. Here I am, lauded by so many, recipient of honors, whereas the poor girl victim, Lizzie, languishes. Craig's book, Two Battles, The Story of a Photographer and a Girl, appeared 4 months later after a rushed printing. The book was ghosted by a bright 22-year-old journalist from Houston named Phil Spark, who was not given credit on the title page.
No. Of course not.
Two Battles sold about 20,000 copies in its first 6 months, thanks to aggressive publicity by its New York publisher and to a good photo of Lizzie Davis on the back of the jacket.
Mm-hmm.
This meant that the sales more than covered Craig's advance, so Craig was going to have more money in his pocket due to royalties. He and Clancy got married and moved into a house with a mortgage.
That is the heterosexual dream.
Uh-huh. He sends a few copies to Lizzie Davis, who sends him back a formal and rather cold note of thanks. But they...
I hoped you were going to say cease and desist.
Nope. But she showed no sign of wanting to see Craig again, and he didn't particularly want to see her again either. And here's the conclusion.
I'm ready.
Craig appeared on a few religious programs on TV, which did his book a world of good. And he dutifully answered almost all his fan mail, though some of it was pretty stupid, from teenagers asking how they could start out being a newspaper photographer.
Craig doesn't know. Craig doesn't know.
Craig has no clue.
No.
Still, contact with the public gave Craig the feeling that he was making new friends everywhere, that America was not merely a big playground, but a friendly and receptive one, which conflicted a bit with his playing the reflective and publicity-shy cameraman. Craig eased himself over this little bump in the road by convincing himself that he had discovered another métier, exploring God and his own conscience. This seemed to Craig an endless path to greater things. Craig decided to tour America with Clancy in his new compact station wagon.
Oh my God.
And to photograph poor families in Detroit and Boston, maybe some in Texas too. And fires, of course. And fires, of course, in case he encountered any. Rape and mugging victims, street urchins of wherever, sad-faced animals in zoos. He would make... He would make himself famous as the photographer compelled to photograph the seamier side of life.
Mm.
He envisaged a book with a few lines under each photograph, which would reflect his personal conflict in regard to God and justice. Craig Rollins was convinced of his own conviction, and that was what counted. Plus, the belief, of course, that such a book would sell. Hadn't he proved by Two Battles that such a book would sell?
Yep.
The end.
I mean, this just sounds like the real story that has basically happened over and over again.
Well, and that's, so one of the things that jumped out at me about this is that it reminded me so much of, like, it feels prescient. Like, it feels like it reflects more on now even than it did when it was written.
I would say that it's a story, I guess, as long as we've had the media, the Fourth Estate, however you want to refer to it, it seems like it's a story that's been repeated, and now it's just in hyperdrive because of social media and everybody's ability to capture stories and images.
Yes. The story, when it was written, it's a dark, ironic humor. You know, it's funny in a very, very dark way. I think it would have read as a lot more overblown.
No, it's not. It's so not.
Like, when it was written, I think it would have come across as a lot more intense in terms of, like, wow, this man's, like, really pulling off a grift as, like, it.
Now we have Dr. Phil.
It feels more banal now, I think, than it did when it came out.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
Like, it was the little details and things, I think, felt more heightened when it was published.
When did daytime talk shows become a thing? I think the 80s, right?
I think it's actually later than that.
Yeah.
Because wasn't one of the first ones, like, was it Ricky Lake?
She had one. I mean, I want to say it was like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of the things that's extra interesting about this story in particular, in terms of Patricia Highsmith, is that she was willfully and wildly out of touch with contemporary, like, with American culture when she was writing the story.
Okay.
She did go on that trip back to the States, and she spent 2 weeks at a friend's house just watching daytime evangelical TV. As research for a novel, which clearly also inspired this story. So she did, she had, like, an immersive 2 weeks, but she also was the kind of writer who moved out of the United States in, like, the 60s.
Okay.
And just kind of stayed gone. Didn't have a television. Like, was
kind of sounds like she knew all she needed to know, though. You know, she got the main points pretty down.
What made Highsmith famous was writing crime fiction, and especially, you know, The Talented Mr. Ripley. It's crime fiction.
He's not a janitor who can do math.
It's,
I'm shocked.
He's a con artist, right? He's a grifter, basically. An elaborate one. But The Talented Mr. Ripley and a lot of her novels are very heavily European.
Oh.
Ripley is a very cultured con artist.
Yeah.
Craig, I think, is her...
corn-fed.
Yeah, like a thoroughly small town American con artist. Because what is more American?
I did not mean that derogatorily, by the way. I love corn-fed peoples.
I was going to be like, who are you worried about offending?
I've mentioned that to people from the, I've, like, met people from the Midwest before, and I, like, say that as, like, a cute thing. Like, ooh, you corn-fed. And I've had people not enjoy that comment.
No, fair enough.
And then I've had other people be like, yeah, I'm corn fed. So, you know, I say it with love.
That's fair. But, like, corn. What is more American than convincing yourself of the truth of your grift?
Oh, yeah.
And also, what is more American than going on the religious angle?
No, like, this is, like, I have almost very little to say about it because this is just sounds like an actual thing that happened about 30 times. So sorry, I don't have any commentary, so the podcast's over, episode's over.
I think there are a few things about it that I find really interesting, and I do think that one of those things, and this is a little awkward and uncomfortable to talk about, because of all of the things that happen outside of the world of this story, but the question of the assault itself, and whether in the world of the story, as characters created by Patricia Highsmith, who described sex with men as being like having steel wool rubbed in your face.
Ooh.
Like, so in the world of the story, again, I cannot be more emphatic about this.
Got it.
Is Lizzie using this as an excuse to not have to deal with men? Because there are parts of the story where it kind of seems that way.
I guess I personally... Okay, and I might have a hard time, like, separating story from, I don't know, personal or reality. To me, it doesn't really matter.
Sure.
Because, I mean, we all know factually that you were held hostage. Like, you were abducted at knife point.
Yeah.
And taken away in, like, a life-threatening situation. And that's traumatic.
Yeah.
And especially if you're, like, what is she, like, 17 or something?
Like 18, maybe?
18, 17, 18. Yeah, if that changes your life in some way or changes your perspective or you, I don't, that it just doesn't really matter to me. Like,
yeah.
And no. Then you're like, you know what? I didn't want to marry that guy anyway. So.
Yeah, no, and that's totally fair. But like, I think that's what Highsmith was attempting to, like, I think that's what Highsmith thinks.
Mm-hmm.
In part because Highsmith also hated women.
Oh, she hates everyone.
But what, so.
Who does she like?
Let's talk for a little bit about
cats?
Patricia Highsmith. She did like cats.
Yeah.
She hated
surprised.
Everyone.
I'm not surprised. Yeah.
She was a bigot.
Mm.
She was an anti-Semite. She was racist.
Ah, wow.
She also hated Nixon and fascists. And
she really hated everyone.
Literally everyone.
Did she like anyone?
No. She very carefully and strategically drove away all of her lovers and alienated all of her friends.
Hmm.
She was impossible to like, impossible to spend time with. That is what that's what a misanthrope is. Like, she was a...
It's not romanticized.
It's not cute. Yeah, like
a younger version of me is like, wow, I want to figure her out. Oh my gosh, I bet I could get her to like me. And like me, you know, me now after therapy is like, well, that sounds f-ing miserable. Good luck with that. Bye.
Yeah, no, she... sucked.
Yeah.
she judged everyone. Mm-hmm. She was an isolationist. She was a big bootstraps gal.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I was reminded of reading her biography is you've watched the show Gentleman Jack, right?
Oh, yeah.
So you know how they portray Anne Lister as being a woman who has no problem with the patriarchy. She's just mad that she's not part of it.
Yeah, yeah.
That's Patricia Highsmith is a misogynist.
Yeah.
And she was funny because she would, you know, she wasn't, no one is unidimensional. And one of the best quotes I could find of her attitudes towards women and feminism come from when a young journalist visited her who was like an open and ardent feminist. And this was in the, I think, very end of the 70s or very early 80s. And it says, and I'm using the biography, The Talented Miss Highsmith by Joan Shenkar, which is very good.
Okay.
And it says,
thanks, Joan.
Pat, straining for a topic that might appeal to a feminist guest, searched her memory to produce some slight evidence of the social injustices suffered by women. She herself had suffered none, she said firmly, and expressed a special disgust for feminists.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. we get this quote because she's trying in a weird way to be hospitable.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to see women as a whole standing on their own feet. I still see them as sort of in relationship to a man, which is very curious because my mother was very, as women go even now, she was definitely rather brave. She had a career since the age of 20, and when she wanted to divorce my father, she did. And my father offered money and so on, you know, for the doctor when I was born, at least. My mother said, no thanks. So I had in my childhood the image of a rather strong, independent woman. And yet I don't see them that way. I see them as a bunch of pushovers, for the most part. I see them as whining, to tell you the truth. Especially this feminist thing. Whining. Always complaining about something, instead of doing something. Men can leave the house. Ripley leaves his house. He's got a wife there, plus a servant. I don't see women leaving the house. Maybe it's just a quirk of mine or something wrong in me.
This is... this reminds me of, like, Piers Morgan. She just sounds like a Fox News anchor or something who just hates everyone.
She, well, but Fox News anchors love other rich white people, and she hates them too. Like, she hates, and I'm not saying this to excuse her viewpoints, but she just hates everyone.
Mm-hmm. Most of all, herself.
Well, yeah. So,
yeah, that's where that comes from.
Well, but also, like, very specifically in a thoroughly documented fashion. So she grew up in a decently religious household.
Mm-hmm.
And she, from a very early age, swung back and forth between defiance and guilt over her own sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point signed herself up for therapy.
Like conversion therapy?
Well, they didn't call it conversion therapy.
Okay.
But she signed herself up for therapy, and part of it was like, fix my gayness.
Yeah.
And it didn't last because she started projecting a bunch of weird emotional shit onto her therapist.
I'm surprised.
And also, I guess, I don't know, I want to use the word thankfully because I think conversion therapy is inherently evil. But as she did any time anyone told her to change anything about herself, the minute it got down to like, and now we're going to try and fix you, she could not resist bridling and basically being like, fuck you.
Yeah.
I'm great.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And also she developed a crush on her therapist pretty quickly, and she was just...
It got messy.
And mm-hmm. she basically could not stop herself from having sex with every woman she could flirt with. So it didn't take...
Well.
But she did have that really deep-seated self-loathing. Like, that is why she drove everyone away. That is what, mm-hmm. like, she was deeply, deeply insecure, and she hated everyone and herself most of all, I think.
Well, you have to keep people at an arm's length so that you don't have to be vulnerable with them.
Well,
so that, because you don't think you're worthy of that love.
Yeah, but...
Little did she know that there would be an entire generation of internet men.
God.
Doing this exact same thing on Reddit. A mere 20 years later.
But like, Patricia Highsmith is one of those figures, one of those writers that you either see floated as this like rah-rah forgotten feminine, you know, like she was a lesbian and she wasn't shy about it and she wrote comics for Marvel in the 50s mm-hmm. and she wrote The Price of Salt, which was like one of the first books ever where lesbians got to have a happy ending, and like, what a pioneer.
Yeah.
And then you get the other side, which is like, look at Patricia Highsmith, this piece of shit.
Yeah.
And I think both are true and both mm-hmm. are irrelevant.
Mm. Why are both irrelevant?
Because she's dead now.
Ah. Yes. Good point. An astute observation on your end, Grace.
Because
I didn't think of that.
Because she's dead now and her books are very, very good and in very wide circulation. And because very interestingly, and I always find it fascinating when this happens, with a few exceptions, her bigotry did not make its way into her work.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
That is unexpected.
I think that it is not infrequent that we look back at people who we think sort of should agree with us in all the right ways because they themselves were marginalized or sort of fighting an uphill battle or were underdogs in one way, and then we find out that they were bigoted in another way.
Mm-hmm.
It's a through line, right? You have famous gay authors who, you know, from any time prior to now, mm-hmm. who were anti-Semitic, or you have famous black authors who turn out to be anti-Semitic. It's a lot of anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
It's just like the mold and the blue cheese of Western life.
Yeah.
But I think it also happens now. Like, you find people, I mean, for something as surface level as like RuPaul be like fracking on their land.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
huh.
The very insecurities that drive someone to make great art or to make interesting art or to pave the way in an art form of any kind, that drive comes from the self-same place that will let you lapse into bigotry if you are not or selfishness, as with like environmental, that kind of thing, if you are not very vigilant about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that's an excuse, but I think maybe we should stop being so surprised when it happens.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And we shouldn't not talk about it. Like, I, you know, I make a point of anytime we cover an author, anytime we cover a book, I'm like, well, there's the racist bit. We found it. Like,
yeah.
I don't think we should gloss over it, but I think we should stop trying to turn especially authors and artists into these kind of like unidimensional, like lesbian powerhouse icon, Patricia Highsmith.
Yeah, like letting people, well, I think that there's a very slow trend towards letting people be messy and complicated and like trying to put people on less of a pedestal. And that might just be within my bubble, but I think there's more conversations about it culturally, at least.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely improving.
Yeah.
No gods, no heroes, baby.
No gods, no heroes.
And so, I mean, some of her bullshit is just very funny. She spent a good amount of time trying to convince herself to marry an English novelist. The one that she had.
A man?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because she really wanted the respect. Like, A of all, I wonder if she would have been happier. If she would have been
in an angry, loveless marriage,
no.
Show marriage.
I mean, maybe.
So would it give her something to target her anger at?
Honestly, maybe.
Save the rest of us.
But it's funny with authors like this. I'm like, would you have been happier if you had been born in 1980 instead of dying in 1990? Or were you just always going to be this furious?
I don't know.
But, you know, back to the story. And the reason that I brought up the idea of whether Lizzie is essentially using this thing that everyone knows about as a convenient means to shun men for life, right? Because that's what Lizzie says. She says, I don't ever want to live with a man and I don't think I ever will.
Yeah.
I think from the perspective of a character and a scenario created by Highsmith, Lizzie is both a f***ed up dream and the manifestation of one of her greatest fears, which is not assault. One of her deepest fears was not being was being perceived and of letting anyone get too close. Like,
yeah.
She hated feeling vulnerable. She hated feeling like anyone understood her too well, and that was why she would
put those walls up,
push people back out of her life with insane bad behavior. Apparently her dinner parties were known for devolving into just terrifying shit shows.
Why would people keep going?
Because she was also apparently fascinating in the way that some people are. She was apparently like riveting.
Yeah.
But also horrible.
Getting tired just thinking.
Honestly, she's exhausting to read about.
Yeah.
She was obsessed with snails.
Ooh, quirky.
She kept them as pets.
I mean, I like snails.
Yeah. But she...
That doesn't mean you'd let me, like, scream at you for 2 hours over dinner.
She really liked keeping snails. She liked to tell people that she kept snails as pets because they copulated for 14 hours at a time sometimes. Anyway.
Wow.
Lizzie, going back to the story.
Yeah. Get off that quirked up shorty.
From Lizzie's perspective, everyone in the town is gossiping about her.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously she's had this very intrusive photograph taken of her. That now means that she's being gossiped about nationally.
Yeah.
Which is horrific from Highsmith's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the photograph is the real violation in this story.
Oh, absolutely. Because, well, and also just the way Highsmith describes it, you get tons of details of the photograph and the photographic processes up. There's zero details. There's zero discussion of the assault rather than just those two words. Like, did it happen? Did the rape happen?
Right.
You know? Whereas, like, the photograph is discussed and described and, you know, picked over. And I think that's, you're very right there.
Because Highsmith is blind, blinded to the inappropriateness of the metaphor that she's using. I think that she is very intentionally positioning this assault as essentially a metaphor for any kind of sexual inappropriateness that is attached to a girl's name and then made very public. If you are publicly damaged goods, or if you are publicly a lesbian, and the whole world knows it, then they're going to stop harassing you about being with a man.
Yeah.
And the little bit of agency that you can take in that scenario, again, from Highsmith's perspective of Lizzie as a character, is to grab that. You've already been violated, right? Your privacy is gone. Everyone is talking about you. But the one thing you can do is grab that and say, you know what? Men are just off the table for me.
Yeah.
And that, from Highsmith's perspective, is a minor triumph. Does that make sense?
It does. And, well, what I was initially thinking, I was thinking about the angle of Lizzie becoming a model, where she's taking the... what's the word I'm looking for? Hold on a second.
She hated Flannery O'Connor.
Work. slay.
She hated she hated Flannery O'Connor because they were at the same writer's retreat, and she went off and got drunk with a bunch of the other people at the writer's retreat, and they all got back, and Flannery O'Connor allegedly was kneeling on a porch in the thunderstorm. And they were like, what are you doing? And she was like, Jesus's face is in this board. And they were like, ooh.
I saw a comment on, I saw a meme that was something, someone in a similar situation, and the comment underneath it was like, so close. It's actually schizophrenia. Heart.
She said, ever since then, I've never liked that woman.
You know, I kind of get it.
She's very funny. She's a horrible person.
She'd be funny. Yeah.
She's very funny.
Yeah. Okay. So Lizzie took the wrong, with the modeling, Lizzie like took the wrong that was done to her and turned it, which I think is, you know, is like a very common trauma response that a lot of people have, and that can be healthy, where you take it and explore it in a safe outlet where you can, that in which you're in control of it. And that's another, and that's similar to, I mean, Highsmith's approach. And I guess Lizzie's approach, like Highsmith's approach is, as you were saying, like if everybody's already talking shit about you, or like the worst possible thing has happened, then what do? You can control the narrative. And how did Highsmith choose to control the narrative or seek control in a situation in which she felt out of control? It was to be an absolute monster.
Just to be a dick.
But you're in control in a way then. You know?
Well, she was also a raging alcoholic.
Well.
Yeah.
Yeah, that tracks as well.
I do think that, like, for an incredibly guilt-ridden queer woman who is just bathing in self-loathing, I think, like, this is part horror story and part fantasy.
Interesting, yeah.
Just the parts of the story about Lizzie. Yeah. And I also think that in true Highsmith fashion, Lizzie is less important than the character study of Craig, right? The darkly humorous sketch of Craig the con artist is the important part here. But I do think it's interesting what she's doing with Lizzie.
With Lizzie in the background.
But man, she wrote some riveting fiction.
Yeah, good for her.
She had a very clear-eyed perspective on the world, or at least a very clear-eyed perspective on the darker parts of the world that she chose to write about.
Yeah.
And people f-ing love The Talented Mr. Ripley. People love that story. People love Strangers on a Train.
He sure solved those math problems.
And she, you know, the rest of her short fiction is fascinating. Like, she has a short story collection called The Animal Lover's Book of Beastly Murder. And it's a series of stories.
I'm a vegetarian. I don't know if I want to hear this.
It's actually, each one is about an animal murdering its owner.
Oh.
Yeah.
Go on.
And they're all written from the animal's perspective. They're fascinating. Oh. They're very, very short. They're these funny little, like, parables. And, like, so one of them is a cat whose owner is dating a man who keeps, like, f***ing with the cat when the owner isn't in the room. And the cat finally, like, pushes him down a flight of stairs when he's drunk. One of them is about an elephant finally crushing a zookeeper.
Nice.
They're all stories of
orcas in the ocean.
Vengeance, yeah.
With the yachts.
They're fast, and they're all, like, 2 pages long.
Yeah.
Like, I spent an entire... I was trying to pick a story for this episode, and I knew I wasn't going to use these because they're very short, and there's not a lot to them unless you take them in a whole.
Yeah.
But they're very good, and they're very funny in these, like, weird little parable ways.
As someone who read Aesop's Fables a lot as a kid, this appeals to me.
I think you would enjoy them.
Yeah.
And then the second collection she did was called Little Tales of Misogyny.
Hmm.
And they're similarly, it's a whole collection, and they're these little vignettes, and each one is a different type of woman. So, like, the coquette, the female novelist, the middle-class housewife, the breeder, the mobile bed object, the silent mother-in-law.
The mobile bed object?
Yeah, it's a...
Sounds like a category on Grindr.
It's about a woman who, like, makes a career of being a kept woman and then finally accidentally shacks up with a mafioso and he kills her.
You know, I was with her. I was rooting for her to... You know, I'm still rooting for her. You know, I hope the best for her in an alternate universe.
Yeah. And, you know, they're not... feminist, obviously.
Yeah.
But they are...
But are the women the punchline?
Sometimes.
Okay.
And sometimes not.
Hmm.
And I think Highsmith is sometimes accidentally feminist just because she is...
Damn it, I did a feminism.
Yeah, like because she is so critical of everything, of every aspect of the society she lived in, of... everyone's faults and foibles. If you are criticizing a society from top to bottom that happens to be a deeply anti-feminist society,
every now and then you'll punch up.
Guess what you're gonna do? Yeah, like you're gonna, it's gonna happen.
Now wait a minute. Okay, was she one of those expats who like shits all over the United States constantly? I mean, you know, like fairly, but then was like, but Europe is so great. Everything's so great about Europe. Europe is perfect.
Good news.
Did she? On Europe too?
Yes.
Rightfully so. There you go, Patty.
There was not a single place she ever visited or lived that she did not hate. She was kind of polite about Switzerland, where she died, but only because she was trying to get citizenship.
She got a little weak on her deathbed.
And they're very conservative there. And she was like, if I talk too much, they might not let me become a citizen.
Yeah. She's like, I sure love those mountains.
And even then, like, she didn't say anything nice.
Yeah.
She just
didn't say anything awful.
Yeah. Like, she spent huge swaths of her adult life living in France and constantly talked the food. And also French people, and refused to learn or speak French.
You know, that's pretty funny.
But,
but you too, Patricia.
I think really the most respectful thing you can do about like with and about her legacy is to just be like, fuck you too, Patricia.
Yeah. Fuck you very much right back at you.
Yep. You know, and not in like a, I don't think she deserves any praise as a person, and I don't think she deserves any emulation. And she's a fine example of why you should not allow teenagers to read Mein Kampf, especially if they have... if they already have delusions of grandeur.
Is that how we got her? Is that how this happened?
It was part of it.
Oh, no.
Yeah. But she also was like...
She read it and she was like, yeah!
Well, she read it as a teenager and parts of it definitely...
And never questioned it again.
Well, but she like lazily like lapsed into anti-Semitism all the time, especially in her private journals, but also like most of her friends...
What a thing to journal about.
And most of her lovers... And most of her professional contacts were Jewish.
Uh-huh.
And she had perfectly fine relations with them and wasn't... I don't know. She just fucking hated everything.
Yeah.
She just hated everything and everyone and used the laziest possible bigotry to express it, at least to herself.
Yeah. Such an obvious shield. Well, one thing that I read in... The body is not an apology is that you can have compassion for people while still holding them accountable. You can have compassion for people, but without excusing their behavior.
I don't think she needs our compassion. She's dead.
Yeah. It's okay. The compassion extends to the point where it's just like you are obviously so fucking miserable and so scared.
Yeah.
And you are turning that on yourself and you're turning it on everyone else. to try to beat them to the punch of not liking you. Like, you're just terrified all the time and you hide behind anger and vitriol.
Yeah.
And I feel bad for you, but also stop.
Well, I mean, maybe in terms of specifically to this podcast, maybe in terms of...
Does that have anything to do with the story? No, but...
Well, no, what I was going to say is, like, maybe in terms of going through the work of dead authors, maybe extending compassion can include extending compassion to the work itself.
Yeah.
Without failing to hold it accountable.
Yeah.
And I think that's fine, you know? I don't know.
Well, what you said earlier really resonates, because if I had read this story in a vacuum and then you asked me to describe who I thought the author was, I would not describe the meanest person across the board that I've ever heard of.
The meanest woman who ever lived.
Yeah.
Patricia Highsmith, the meanest woman who ever lived.
Whoever lived. Yeah. So it's just interesting that, Do you separate art from artist or no?
Yes and no.
Yeah.
When it comes to classic literature, my stance is that whether or not we like it, the work itself has already had an impact, right? It's already been published. It's already been read by thousands and thousands, if not millions, of people.
Yeah.
It's already been handed down. It's already had an effect on all of the literature that came after it.
It's already been turned into a Netflix show.
And the author is fucking dead.
Yeah.
There's no accountability. They're dead now.
Yeah. Fuck you, Patricia.
And I don't think that, like, attempting to cancel them or whatever from beyond the grave accomplishes anything. Because if we forget what these influences are, we will stop seeing them, right? I said something earlier about anti-Semitism being the mold and
the through line.
The mold and the blue cheese of Western society. If we do not remember that these bigotries shaped our entire literary canon and and address and explore the specific ways in which they did, we won't notice the parts of them we're still carrying forward without even thinking about it.
Yeah.
Right?
Anti-Semitism, colonialism, anti-Black racism, you know, genocide.
The list
all of it
goes,
like,
on.
Yeah.
Misogyny.
Yeah.
Rape cult. Like, it's just bad.
That's very true. You have to remember. Yeah.
But I think that we can and should be very alert to what we are publishing now. The authors who are still alive, whose work can still be engaged with as part of their legacy, whose attitudes can still be engaged with. I think that anyone still giving J.K. Rowling any money is a fucking dipshit.
Yeah.
She's a objectively horrible person who has proved over and over again that she does not care who she hurts.
Yeah.
Fuck her.
I'm trying to think of a Harry Potter joke, but I just don't even care.
Because those...
Wingardium Leviosa, shut your mouth.
Because we know what she thinks. We know what bigotries she is working with.
Yeah, she's got a Twitter.
And a lot of people who care a lot more about this than I do have gone through the books and written thoughtful and compelling academic pieces about all of the little bigotries that are hidden in those books. We do not have to allow them to become part of the canon.
Yeah.
We don't have to keep perpetuating them.
Yeah.
We can let them go.
Yeah, like, I know a lot of people who really love Harry Potter.
Sure.
And I think that is an important distinction to make, is that you can let that have that place in your heart and your memory as much as you want. Like, you can take that art, you can appreciate it for what it was and what it meant to you, and also accept the reality of who that person is now and stop giving them your fucking more money.
Yeah.
And stop giving them the platform, you know?
We are deciding right now what will become the canon we hand down to generations after us.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we should choose it carefully.
Yes.
So do I separate art from artist? Sometimes.
Yeah.
It depends on the context.
Yes.
It's very nuanced.
That is the answer to most questions.
I really thought we'd wind up talking more about, like, the sort of contemporary side of the story, but I guess it's pretty fucking self-explanatory.
What's the contemporary side of the story?
Just, like, how contemporary it feels in terms of, like, you know, the very specific grift he pulled off. But I feel like it's probably just very self-explanatory.
I would say for that, I would recommend listening to the podcast Maintenance Phase, yeah, where most episodes are just this sort of thing happening.
Grifts!
In real life. What's the biggest grift you ever pulled? Girls, grifts, and...
Gaslight, gatekeep, girl boss. Gaslight, gatekeep, girl grift.
Gaslight, gatekeep, girl grift.
All right. Who is your favorite of the, like, contemporary grifters that have floated up out of the ether in the last...
Oh, man.
Like, somebody who managed to do exactly one thing right, maybe by accident, and then just fucking ran with it into the sunset.
I don't know. I've had bosses like that. Fyre Festival was pretty funny. I watched both those documentaries.
Fyre Festival was definitely
pretty funny.
Those are some Craigs. Those are some solid Craigs.
Oh yeah.
Just
big Craig energy.
Massive Craig energy. Just the kind of people that you know didn't intend to wind up in charge of a music festival. And then somehow were.
That one guy, well, he seemed pretty intent on it.
I just feel like, you know, there's like a running thing about like whether or not Donald Trump really thought he would become president when he started trying to run for president.
Yeah.
And the point is moot. He's terrifying.
Yeah.
But I get the vibe that a lot more con artists are Craigs than we realize.
Oh, for sure.
And that they don't ever expect to get as far as they do. And then suddenly they've gotten too far.
Yeah.
And they can't go back.
Yeah. No, yeah, because you got a lot of money on it.
Yeah.
Do you have a favorite grifter?
Oh. I have a special spot in my heart for that woman who was pretending to be the, like, vaguely European heiress.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Anna Delvey.
Why do you look poor? Yeah. You know, that, I mean, that's an impressive grift.
I respect the grind for Anna Delvey. She was working.
She did it.
That is the difference, right? Between a mediocre white man failing up and never having to actually do his job ever again.
Yeah.
And a young...
And an icon, a legend.
Woman.
The moment.
Fighting,
the diva.
Fighting the patriarchy. Grinding away on her grift.
Yes. Rise and grind.
She is gaslighting. She is gatekeeping. She is girl bossing. It is a full-time job.
Yes. I agree. America.
This is apparently now an Anna Delvey fan podcast. Also the Theranos lady. Honestly, Elizabeth Holmes, I'm more impressed than anything else.
That, yeah.
I mean, she's a bad person.
Yeah.
But like, damn.
Wild.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
Woo.
This has been an adventure. Thanks. Thanks so much for coming down this road with me.
Thank you for guiding me.
Do you have any closing thoughts on where the action is, or Highsmith, or
what do we think happened to Tom?
Tom,
sexy photo daddy.
Sexy photo daddy. Tom probably had a long, wonderful career. Whereas I'm guessing Craig seems like he probably sharply fell off and then found himself with no money and. You know?
I feel like Craig wound up on TV.
Yeah.
And then...
Probably had some kind of scandal.
A scandal. Yeah. Breakdown. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Craig seems like there would be like a...
Wound up on TV. Lot of money. Lot of like donations. Mm-hmm. And then was like fully doing a big financial fraud.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And like went to... I don't know. Got busted by the feds.
He'd be one of those ones where he was fully doing a big financial fraud through sheer stupidity, like wasn't even doing it on purpose, and would still wind up going down.
He just had like the wrong formula plugged into the spreadsheet or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or like just would just be like, I have to pay taxes? What?
Me? I'm just a little guy.
I think Tom... clearly has an excellent understanding of work-life balance, and he probably just spent the rest of his life in the town in Wyoming, and he probably found a very hot partner of whatever gender he preferred.
Yes.
And took great nude photos of his partner in his off time.
Got into boudoir photography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And had a lovely career, a nice life, maybe kids if he, you know, is into that kind of thing.
Sure.
And When he finally saw the news about Craig's downfall, he chuckled a little to himself, but not in a mean way.
Oh, Craig.
Yeah. Maybe even like sent Craig a postcard being like, hey, buddy.
Yeah.
Put a little money in his canteen.
Aw.
When he's in the pen for doing white collar crimes.
Yeah.
I think that's what happened to Tom.
I think that's very nice.
Beautiful photo, Daddy.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
I really enjoyed it.
Yes.
And thank you all so much for being here today. I hope you enjoyed our somewhat unwieldy, but I think very fun conversation.
Important.
Be a better dinner guest than Patricia Highsmith was. That's my advice for everyone today.
Yeah, snails are cool and all, but they don't excuse racism.
Also true. Yes. This is we're gonna do a mug that says that. Snails, yeah, don't excuse racism. It'll just be a little snail being like, meow. We will be back next week with more alarmingly relevant book content.
Woo!
And in the meanwhile, if you can, this week, this month, this pay period, consider supporting a living author. Because they could sure use the love.
But like a cool one.
Yeah, one who doesn't suck.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Bye.
Bye.
Didn't Read It was created, written, recorded, and edited by me, Grace Todd. You can follow the show on Instagram or Twitter at Didn't Read It.
Our theme song is Books, written, performed, and recorded by William Albritton.
For sources cited and a full list of episodes, you can visit us at didn'treaditpod.com.
If you enjoyed the show, please consider leaving us a review. It makes a big difference and we appreciate it immensely.
If you did not enjoy the show, we are accepting applications for a full-time nemesis at didn'treaditpod@gmail.com. Special thanks to Black Iris Social Club in Richmond, Virginia, and to Pescatrio Publishing.